Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. In this episode, we'll feature an interview with Doug Batema, professor of communication from Western New England College, to discuss the academic study of sports media in the United States. The following interview was recorded on Saturday, May 1st, 2010. We are joined on the phone by Doug Batema. Doug Batema is a professor of communication at Western New England College in Springfield, Massachusetts, and he is joining us on the phone from Springfield, Massachusetts, to talk about sports media in the United States. Professor Batema, Doug, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mitchell. Nice to be here.
Good. It's good to have you with us. I'm going to read an excerpt of a presentation, a write-up of a presentation that you gave at a panel that you and I had both attended and presented at the University of Texas at Austin, at a conference there. You were talking about sports and the academic analysis of sports media. There's a write-up here that reads, "Historically, sports have been central to American television networks, corporate and civic identities, but they have consistently fallen through the cracks of academic study." So let me begin, two questions embedded within that quote that I just read. One is, give us some of the ways in which sports are central to TV networks, corporate and civic identities.
Well, if we go back all the way to the beginning, the first networks were put together in order to broadcast a couple of sporting events, boxing match in 1920 and then the 1922 and 23 World Series. And then when network and those kind of ad hoc networks persisted for quite a while. Then in the late 1920s, when both NBC and CBS started up, both of them aired major sporting events as special programming. And it was kind of interesting because they defined those events as public interest programming. And this had to do in part with some legal language in the Radio Act of 1927 that said that the networks had to operate in the public interest, convenience, or necessity. And the networks argued that, these kinds of major sporting events, baseball's World Series and the Kentucky Derby, speaking to you on Derby Day, the Kentucky Derby and major boxing matches were in the national interest. They helped to hold us as Americans together. And we radio networks are also holding Americans together. We're creating this great national polity. And so they persisted in airing major events and seeing those as in the public interest. And something really interesting happened because they aired those initially, the World Series and those major events, as what was called sustaining programming, meaning they were not sponsored. The networks footed the bill for the whole thing. And they also agreed that they would not compete for the rights to broadcast those events. So NBC, both of NBC's networks, they had two networks at the time, the Red and the Blue, and CBS, and later on Mutual, would carry the World Series all at once. So there wasn't any bidding for exclusive rights. And again, they argued that because it was essential to the way in which they were defining their mission. When Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis actually sold rights to baseball World Series broadcast to the Ford Motor Company in 1933, the original contract stipulated that Ford would pay for the rights, and they would also pay the equipment costs for the broadcaster, but they only wanted one network, NBC's Red Network, which was the more popular network, to carry it. And the networks hemmed and hawed and protested. CBS said this was unfair. NBC, interestingly, said this is unfair. This is not the way we've always done it. And they successfully pressured Ford and Landis to agree to have all networks broadcast it. Where this gets really interesting is in looking at some of the memos in the NBC archives in Madison, Wisconsin from the time, where a whole bunch of NBC executives got together and said, essentially, look, we think that these kinds of events, these major national events, should be broadcast on all networks, period. But if they're going to be exclusive, we have to get them. We have to get the exclusive rights, because these are prestigious events. These are things that define who we are as a nation. And we at NBC want to be defined as quintessentially American. And they pursued exclusive rights to the World Series, later on to sporting, to the NFL, to the Olympics, et cetera, et cetera. And I would imagine that similar kinds of discussions were going on at CBS at the time. I don't have any proof of that, but it seems in keeping with the way that they tended to think. So that has been the way that networks have sort of thought of themselves and presented themselves. From an economic standpoint, too, these networks, NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, you name it, have always looked at sports as a great way to legitimate themselves. The Fox network, for instance, was really considered a fourth banana among the networks, despite the success of shows like The Simpsons, until they got NFL rights in the early 1990s. That was when the television industry sort of said, okay, Fox is here to stay, they're not going anywhere. And I would argue that one of the reasons that the CW, which used to be UPN and WB, those sort of two networks that started up in the mid-1990s, I'd argue one of the reasons they were never successful, really, is that they never had a sports contract. So that's sort of the long-winded way of answering your question there.
And the, I guess the second part of the question, despite this, the role that sports have played with regards to broadcast television media in American broadcasting history, academia, when it comes to a kind of formal scholarly analysis of this, hasn't really kept up, and it's, as you've said, that it's consistently fallen through the cracks of academic study. Could you tell us a little bit about why that's happened?
Yeah, well, I think it's happened for a number of reasons. You know, there one clear reason, I think, is that it doesn't neatly fit. Most of the time, academics are looking at television content or the way in which television networks operate, and they're looking at news programming. So, you know, these networks are presenting the truth, or they're not presenting the truth, or they're presenting a skewed version of events or whatever. So they're looking at television content as nonfiction programming. Or they're looking at television programming as fictional content. So they're looking at, sitcoms, they're looking at dramas, they're looking at those kinds of things. And both of those are pretty easy to study, relatively speaking. One, there's already a framework set up, an intellectual framework set up, to understand the way in which those things work or ought to work. Then with respect to fictional programming, there's a script, there are episodes, they can be taped, they have some value, you could rewatch them, et cetera, et cetera. Their value is not simply in their immediacy. And then with respect to non-fictional programming, you know, their value is tied in part to real-world events, these things that lie outside of television. And when we're studying those, we can look at the news around the real event and, you know, sort of study them for what they are. and anything that's important, anything that's really truly important and is momentous will be studied both as an event and as a mediated event. Well, sports doesn't neatly fit either one of those parameters, because if we think about it, really, sports are fictional programming. There's a narrative around them. All sports, sort of by definition, whether they're mediated or not, follow a basic script, a basic narrative. You know, what's a baseball game? A baseball game is 9 innings. You have 9 players on a side, maybe 10 if you've got the designated hitter. You've got subs. You've got et cetera, et cetera. And you know how the game is going to be played, right? You know the rules. You know that there's going to be a certain number of outs, a certain number of hits or not, and the game is going to unfold. The only difference is exactly how it's going to unfold. And a season is the same thing, right? We've got, at the beginning of any Major League Baseball season, 32 teams. They're all in contention, okay, except for the Kansas City Royals. All right, 31 teams are in contention. And they are going to play the season, and things are going to unfold, and all of these different events are going to mean something, and then we get to the end of the season, we play the World Series, we crown a winner, and then we repeat the process the next year. It's not terribly different from the way in which a fictional program works. There's a narrative built to it. And at the same time, sports also have some of that element of the non-fictional programming, because there's something absolutely real about it and undeniable about it. You know, if you watch Peyton Manning throw a touchdown pass, you can't deny that it happened. It did. What that means is structured in part by sort of a non-fictional understanding of what just happened, as well as what it means in terms of the larger fictional narrative. And so when we're looking at sports, it's kind of messy. It's not news, not in the way that we tend to think of televised news or mediated news. It's not entertainment. It's sort of both. And because it's both, it winds up getting studied academically by neither. So that kind of messiness, that lack of clear categorization of where sports should fit, means that it doesn't really fit anywhere. It falls between the cracks. We don't study it, at least not as a sustained feature of media or of life in general. And it's interesting, if you look at most histories of television or of radio or of media generally, they'll talk about sports, but they'll sort of isolate it. They'll stick it in. They'll stick in a reference here or there. And the only way that we get away from that is if the sport itself or an aspect of sports itself is the subject of study, in which case any reference to media is sort of jammed in there a little bit. So it just doesn't fit. And I think that that's actually the key reason that it's not studied terribly well academically. But there are other reasons. You know, I think in part academics, like a lot of other people, are fans. Many of them are, at least. And they may want to have sports remain outside their field of study because it's an escape. It's something that gets them away from what they do on an everyday basis. They probably, you know, academics probably haven't been taught to see it seriously. Look, this is not really a legitimate field of academic study. I sort of stumbled into it. You know, I'd been a sports fan all my life. I'd written my undergraduate thesis about Jackie Robinson. And when I was pursuing my master's degree, it didn't really occur to me that, hey, I could really do something meaningful and study this sport and this that I love. You know, it's just not on the radar for most people. You know, there's also the possibility that, you know, we tend to see sports in a lot of ways as kind of a conservative bastion. And I think that this is a more recent development, but we associate it with politically conservative movements, and academics, by and large, tend to be less likely to be conservative than the rest of the American public. And so if they do feel that sports are a bastion of conservative politics or conservative identity making or whatever, that it's not worth studying. It's not something that they just want to get into.
In your write-up as well, you also suggest, I wouldn't call this a solution, but a very interesting proposal. You write, comprehending sports function within the media system effectively requires a careful analysis of both the representational strategies within televised sports content and the industrial position sports occupy. Now, by industrial position sports occupy, I take it you're referring to that kind of political economic context that sports fit within the major American broadcast media. There's an audience there. You can produce something, you can sell ads for it, and you can make money in its broadcast. Is that what you mean by industrial position?
That's a good chunk of it. There's also, you can also think of this as the ultimate sort of special event programming, wherein if the World Series is occurring, advertisers or program producers will not necessarily mind all that much if you bump their programming for a week in order to put this on. So sports also provide a way of legitimately bumping something else off the schedule. Mm. But anyway, yes.
But also what you're talking about is the representational strategies within televised sports content. Now, I guess we should take two questions are embedded there. One is, what do you mean by representational strategies? And two, with whatever could that be, could that trump or be trumped by that kind of industrial position part that we discussed?
Well, okay, let me try to answer this sequentially, because I think that answering the first will help explain the second. What I mean by representational strategies is, what does this mean? Why are sports important? What do they do for us? Really, what sports do is tell us a little bit about who we are, what we value. So if we're looking at the way in which, this is not an older example, but one that I think works here, if we look at the way in which Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding were depicted during the 1994 Olympics, we get a sense of what kind of representational strategies we're talking about here. Both of them are female athletes, and as such, they tend to be framed in a way that's a bit different from the way in which male athletes tend to be framed. And this might be changing, arguably, but at the time, at least, I don't think it was. Then when the whole scenario came to light about Harding and her, Harding maybe paid somebody to attack Kerrigan, et cetera, et cetera, then it set up this great dynamic wherein Nancy Kerrigan could be depicted as sort of the good woman, the embodiment of everything that's good about women. She's attractive, conventionally speaking. She's well-spoken. She's got class. She's got style, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then on the other side of the coin, you get Tonya Harding. She's the bad girl. She's the one who's not quite as good-looking and seems classless or lower class. So when CBS is depicting those two on the ice, off the ice, running those feature stories about them, they're framing what these two people mean to society, to our understanding of who Americans are, who and what women are, what's a good woman, what's a bad woman, what's an attractive woman, what's a not attractive woman, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I mean by representational strategies. Now, as far as relating that to the industrial position of sports, the one of the compelling things about sports, the reason that people watch, the reason that networks are willing to pay so much money for the rights to sports, is because we get those stories, we're willing to watch and listen to those stories, and because they speak to who we are in a way that, in a lot of cases, other programs don't necessarily. There's something in sports for everyone. That's how we tend to think about them. That's not necessarily true of any other kind of programming. And, you know, if you look at the Olympics in particular, there's a reason I seized on the 94 Olympics to illustrate this. If you look at the Olympics in particular, there is something in the Olympics for everybody. It tells us something about who Americans are on the world stage. We get to learn a little bit about other cultures. We get to understand where America is vis-a-vis other cultures. And by the way, it's almost always on top because of the medal count, right? And we get to see our athletes doing their best and excelling, and people are pushing themselves to the limits, trying to test what's possible and what isn't. And boy, that's a great, dramatic story. So industrially speaking, this is kind of a story that writes itself. You don't have to pay the athletes. You don't have to pay the actors. You don't have to pay script writers. You don't have to pay people for this, that, and the other thing. All you have to do is set up a camera, have the rights to it, and have some people narrate it. And then, you know, if you've got these canned pieces already done, and you know, for at least the last several decades, any network broadcasting the Olympic Games puts on, creates a lot of canned footage. They put the stories in place ahead of time, so that when and if something happens, they can trot out the appropriate story, the one that fits the moment best. And industrially speaking, it's a safer bet, a surer bet than most other kinds of programming that they can put out.
Do you think that if we were to have a better academic presence of an analysis of sports media, that it would kind of follow this kind of trajectory? Or if not, do you any vision or foreseeing about how this might be if it were better pursued or more sensibly pursued in United States academia?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I'm biased here. I think that looking at it in terms of both the way in which representational strategies play out and the industrial position that sports occupy would sort of be the way that it looks. Instead, what we tend to do is if we turn our attention to sports, academics tend to look at the representational strategies, or they tend to look at the industrial position that sports occupy. They don't do both. And what that often results in is a sort of fragmented understanding. There are these massive gaps. You know, well, okay, yeah, I understand that you're telling me that Michael Johnson in 96 meant this, or that David Beckham on TV now means that. you know, what about X? You know, some other sport or something along those lines. And, you know, it just leads to a really unsatisfying kind of dynamic. I think that if we were to put the two together, that would be a really fascinating endeavor. To give you a quick example of what this might look like, we just got through the NFL draft, which, you know, was unprecedentedly in prime time, got wall-to-wall coverage, you know, and there were stories about it, you know, for weeks leading up to the draft itself. What does this mean? What are teams going to do? How are they going to strategize, et cetera, et cetera? Well, you know, just talking about the draft alone occupied a great deal of ESPN's airtime. And, you know, so if we're going to look at that from an industrial academic perspective, you know, we have to say, well, this is really cheap to do. You know, you need a couple of talking heads. You get John Gruden, you get Mel Kiper, you get Stuart Scott, and a couple other people together, and great, you just shoot, and these folks will talk about their opinions of the different players. It doesn't cost But at the same time, we have to look at the kinds of representations and the representational strategies involved with that. Well, what are we prioritizing here? We're prioritizing a sport that in the U.S. is played almost exclusively by men, not always, but pretty much. It values size, speed, all of these things that we associate with masculinity. And if you look at the ratings for draft coverage, it was pretty much mostly men watching. The same is not true necessarily, by the way, for football. Football's audience historically has been about 60-40 male-female.
Hmm.
Draft coverage, it's male. I think that looking at the implications of that representational strategy, the way in which a sort of male perspective is imbricated within that televisual perspective would be necessary, would be fruitful. I think that's sort of the best way to proceed. I think that we can continue to a lesser degree treating those in isolation, and there's some value in that on a case-by-case basis, but it does not necessarily lead to a real thorough or deep understanding of the way in which sports really function within our media system and therefore within our culture.
We've been speaking with Professor Doug Badema. He is a professor of communication at Western New England College in Springfield, Massachusetts, and he's been talking with us about sports media in the United States and the academic study of same from Springfield, Mass. Professor Badema, Doug, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Mitchell. Thanks very much.
That was an interview with Doug Badema, recorded on May 1st, 2010. The paper quoted in the interview summarizing Professor Badema's presentation is linked at the website of Flow TV, online at flowtv.org. That's flowtv.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.